today to the penultimate commandment of the ten, number 9, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbour. You'll find it in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 20. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbour. The ministry of truth was startlingly different from any other object in sight. It was an enormous pyramidal structure of glittering white concrete, soaring up terrace after terrace, 300 metres in the air. From where Winston stood, it was just possible to read, picked out on its white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. Lines, of course, from George Orwell's novel 1984, the opening chapter. Among other things, that novel is a very chilling warning of the way in which tyranny sustains itself by means of lies. Lies that purport to be truth. It's the hallmark of totalitarianism, suggests Orwell, that it manipulates the evidence. It distorts the facts. It rewrites the history. It even inverts the meaning of language itself in order to sustain its control over the thoughts of men and women. Nothing, suggests Orwell then, is more vital to the preservation of liberty than a moral commitment to the truth. And it is just such a moral commitment to truth that the 9th commandment is all about. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbour, it reads. On the surface, perhaps a rather banal, even petty imperative. Besides the more sensational crimes of murder and adultery and theft that we've been looking at in previous weeks, lying, I guess, to many of us seems a comparatively trivial offence. But I want to suggest to you this morning that it is not so. Rightly understood, the 9th commandment is every bit as weighty and as important as any of the others we've looked at this term. For it guards a principle we neglect to our peril, the principle of the sanctity of truth. According to the Bible, truth is an absolute moral value grounded in the very personal character of God himself. God is true. And because he is true, truth matters absolutely. If we do not stand for truth, if we do not speak the truth with integrity and courage, then we play into the hands of one whom Jesus identified as the liar and the father of lies. In that connection, it's worth noting that there was no censorship in ancient Israel, no official secrets act laid down in the law, or any equivalent of it. The government had no mandate to interfere with anything anybody said unless it was both demonstrably false and damaging. False witness against one's neighbour. As a result of that huge orbit of permission, the government was open to public criticism in a way that was almost unprecedented in the ancient world. The prophets were the key, of course. They enjoyed extraordinary liberty to contradict state propaganda and rebuke the political establishment. But they could not be touched. Constitutionally, their freedom of speech was inalienable. Israel had been taught to see truth as a moral absolute, grounded in a higher authority than the state, and which therefore commanded a higher loyalty than loyalty to the state. Truth mattered absolutely. In Israel, nobody had the moral right to suppress or distort the truth, not even the king. You shall not bear false witness. That was the law. And I say again, if we do not stand in that tradition of the prophets and speak the truth and stand for the truth with integrity and courage in our day, we play into the hands of the liar, who is first cousin to Big Brother. What I want us to do this morning, then, is to identify three areas where it seems to me neglect of the truth may allow such demonic access into our society today. The three areas I want to look at are, first of all, the area of slander and false accusation, which, when they become characteristic of society, and particularly characteristic of the law courts, subvert justice. The second is the whole area of deceit and dishonesty, which, once that becomes characteristic of the community at large, destroys the fabric of interpersonal trust upon which honest business dealings depend. And the third is the area of heresy and false teaching, which in our day, I believe, is undermining the very concept of truth itself within the church. And that potentially has enormously dangerous implications for our whole Western culture. So let's look at those three aspects. This is not a minor commandment at all we're looking at. First of all, the issue of slander and false accusation. Perhaps if we've had a quote from Orwell, we can also have a quote from Othello. Good name in man or woman is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse steals trash. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed. Again, I think the Bible's disposed to agree. Slander is a particularly spiteful form of falsehood, robbing a person of their reputation. It's Solomon in the book of Proverbs who expounds it at greatest length. He outlines the social alienation slander generates. Slander stirs up dissension among brothers. It separates close friends, he says. He observes the malicious satisfaction which it sometimes affords to the hearer. The word of the slanderer is like choice morsels that go down to a man's inmost parts, he says. And he observes the cruel injury, perhaps that more than anything, which it inflicts upon its victim. Like a club or a sword or a sharp arrow is the man who gives false testimony against his neighbour. Of course, if you examine the motive that lies behind slander, what you often discover is simple envy. Isn't that so? Oscar Wilde comments, "It's comparatively easy to be sympathetic to the sufferings of a friend, but it takes a particularly fine spirit to be sympathetic to a friend's success." Yes, often we're not sympathetic to our friend's successes at all, are we? We just envy them. How do we feel when we're confronted by that person who is the business success we always wanted to be but never were? How do we feel when we meet the girl who's got to university when we didn't manage to get GCSE? How do we feel? How are some of us going to feel when our best friend bursts through the door in a few weeks' time and says, "I got a first"? How does the single girl feel when she hears her best friend has just got engaged to a good-looking millionaire? Well, we feel envious, don't we? Green-eyed. That's the natural reaction when you're confronted by good fortune or superiority in others. So what do? We pick holes. We criticize. We smear. We find fault. We gossip. We sling mud. Slander all too often has its roots, doesn't it, in this wounded ego, this threatened pride that can't admire without resentment or cynicism. You know what they say? If you want to find a person's faults, praise him to his friends. They'll soon tell you. Do not bear false testimony against your neighbour, says God's law. Slander is a very vicious calumny. And never more vicious than when it infiltrates the law courts. Almost certainly the most immediate and, if you like, direct and narrow meaning of the ninth commandment for ancient Israel was in relation to the prohibition of perjury. This was especially important to Israel because, according to the legal procedure God lays down for the Jews, conviction of a criminal had to be based on the evidence of witnesses. We, of course, take that fairly much for granted because we are inheritors of the same kind of jurisprudence. But there were other methods of determining guilt in the ancient world and indeed in the modern world too. There's trial by forced confession, for instance. A visit to Madame Tussaud in London is never complete without an inspection of that wax reconstruction of a medieval torture chamber, is it? Fully equipped with every imaginable instrument of inflicting pain. And it still goes on today, of course, whether we're just talking about police brutality in the interviewing room or electric shocks administered by some neo-fascist regime in Latin America. Conviction by forced confession is all too real even in the 20th century. Then there was trial by ordeal, too. In the Middle Ages, they used to try witches by the so-called ducking stool. This was a device which more or less immersed the person in water rather longer than they get immersed here in a baptismal service. If they were still alive when they came up, they were ruled as guilty. Only a witch could do that and were promptly burnt at the stake. If they had drowned, well, they were pronounced innocent and presumably they prayed for their souls. There are many similar dubious methods of establishing a verdict in the ancient world, plunging the hand into boiling water, carrying a hot iron, drinking poison, ritual combat. The nearest equivalent today, I suppose, is the lie detector. Trial by ordeal. Invented in the early years of the 20th century in California, the lie detector is supposed to be able to incriminate a suspect by measuring his blood pressure or his pulse under questioning. One of these days, you know, somebody's going to replace the magistrate's bench by a computer. And that'll be real trial by ordeal. Well, suffice it to say, no such provision for trials by torture or ordeal were made in the law of Moses. The judicial procedures of Israel were based on testimony. And it's for that reason that perjury was such a serious crime. Every effort was made to prevent conviction on false evidence. An important chapter in this connection is Deuteronomy 19. If you're quick with your fingers and you can find it, you might like to look it up. Deuteronomy 19, there's a section all about witnesses at the end, from verse 15 onwards. For instance, Deuteronomy 19, verse 15, lays down that there has to be corroboration among the witnesses. One witness is not enough to convict a man. A matter must be established by two or three witnesses, we're told. In addition, there had to be cross-examination. In verse 18 of Deuteronomy 19, the judges must make a thorough investigation to establish that the accusation is not malicious. But perhaps most significant and interesting of all, the penalty for perjury in Israel could be extremely severe. Look at verse 19 of Deuteronomy 19. If the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against his brother, then, says Moses, you are to do to him as he intended to do to his brother. In other words, whatever penalty the law would have appointed for the crime that this man was falsely being accused of, his false accuser should bear. And in the case, of course, of a capital offence, that would be execution. Now, this is far from irrelevant to us. This week marks the first anniversary of the release of the Birmingham Six. It's perhaps worth reflecting on these Old Testament rules of evidence in that connection. Provisions like these in Deuteronomy 19 may well seem a frustrating encumbrance to a harassed policeman, eager to secure a conviction, certain that the person he's got is guilty. But such rules of evidence are a vital defense against false accusation and the oppression of the innocent that goes with it. I'm quite sure if the officers of the West Midlands Police had thought that the penalty for manufacturing evidence against, say, the Birmingham Six was going to be life imprisonment for themselves, their notebooks would have been kept with a great deal more scrupulousness. And British justice, I suspect, would have been spared a very serious embarrassment. There are, of course, many places in the world today where Big Brother succeeds in intimidating people by means of corrupt judicial systems. Amnesty International have lists of countless thousands of people who have been falsely imprisoned and falsely executed. And we must not think that our British reputation for fair play means that our courts are immune to such abuse. The case of the Birmingham Six is just one of several cases in recent days which have revealed how vulnerable even the Old Bailey is to the influence of the lie. If we're going to get the devil out of the British legal system, everybody, including our police, are going to have to learn the meaning of the Ninth Commandment again. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Slander and perjury subvert justice and ruin people's reputations in a most callous and cruel way. The second area I want us to think about in connection with the Ninth Commandment is the area of deceit and dishonesty. For where these proliferate in society as a whole, the fabric of interpersonal trust, which particularly the commercial life of a society depends on, is broken down. It's in Leviticus 19 that we find a passage which is of use here, I think. Here's an interpretation or an exposition of the Ninth Commandment, which lies in this direction, verse 11 to 13 of Leviticus 19. Notice the way in which here we find the Eighth Commandment and the Ninth Commandment wedded together. Do not steal, do not lie, do not deceive one another, do not swear falsely by my name, do not defraud your neighbor or rob him. That's the succession of Moses' logic in those commandments. Do not steal, do not lie, do not deceive one another, do not swear falsely by my name, and do not defraud your neighbor or rob him. Of course, expressed in the absolute way that those verses do there, do not deceive one another, do not lie, does raise some difficulties for us in real life on occasion. Aren't there occasions where telling a falsehood is permissible or even necessary? There are those, of course, who insist that the truth should always be told without any hesitation or qualification, and the consequences left in God's hands, as it were. The George Washington spirit, who, remember, confessed to his father, "Yes, Dad, I did it. I cannot tell a lie. I cut down the cherry tree with my little hatchet," and was promptly rewarded for his honesty, though presumably not for his pruning techniques. So, say some, telling the truth, no matter what the consequences, will always work out in the best. You have to trust God that it will be so. But one does have to say that in this real world, we are not always dealing with people as morally upright as George Washington's father. I mean, what about when the homicidal maniac knocks on my door brandishing a knife and asks whether my daughter is in? Surely in such circumstances, argue others, there is such a thing as a white lie. Indeed, some would argue further that to break the Ninth Commandment, there must not only be an intention to deceive, but also an intention to injure. It forbids, they say, false witness against my neighbor. If there is no malicious intent, a falsehood, they say, may not be sinful at all. And one does have to say that there are instances in the Bible which seem to support such a view, at least on rare occasions. There is Rahab, for instance, who told a lie to protect the Jewish spies in Jericho and who was praised for her faith in doing so. There are the Hebrew midwives who told at least a half-truth to thwart the genocidal ambitions of Pharaoh, and again are praised for fearing God. And there is Samuel, in 1 Samuel 16, who avoids kindling King Saul's suspicions by anointing David as king in his place secretly, whilst assuring the elders of Bethlehem, David's town, that he had only come to the city to do nothing more politically dangerous than to offer a sacrifice or two. On that third occasion, it's God himself who instructs the prophet to prevaricate in that way. I don't know how George Washington would have handled such situations, I'm sure, but it does seem to me that the Bible recognizes there are occasions where a lie, if not white, may be a shade of gray. In this fallen world, we are not always presented with simple choices between good and evil. The best we can sometimes do is to choose the lesser of two evils. And I think that's what Rahab and the midwives and Samuel were doing. To tell a lie, no doubt, was wrong, but it was a lesser wrong than being an accomplice to murder or stirring up a revolution or something of that sort. Notwithstanding, though, such exceptional situations, the general principle of God's law on this matter is not in doubt, and Leviticus 19 does spell it out. Do not lie and do not deceive one another, it says. And Paul repeats it in the New Testament in Ephesians 4. Each of you must put off falsehood, he says, and speak truthfully to his neighbor, for we are all members of one body. That's an interesting additional phrase. Truth, says Paul, is something we owe one another as a consequence of our social solidarity in the community, the Christian community he's talking about specifically there. Of course, one corollary of that debt of truthfulness that we owe one another is that we must value the truth when people tell it to us and not resent their candor. An honest answer, says Solomon, is like a kiss on the lips. Well, sometimes an honest answer feels more like a punch in the stomach. The truth can hurt, we all know that. But though it may be less complimentary than the oily charm of the flatterer, a truthful answer is a great deal more loving. It's no good getting offended when we ask someone's opinion on something then and find they tell us what we don't want to hear. That doesn't mean, of course, that we're under obligation to tell all the truth we know at every opportunity. Sometimes diplomacy does dictate that we are, to use a phrase of Mark Twain, economical with the truth. There may be charitable ways of expressing things which, whilst not misleading the hearer, may soften the antagonism they might otherwise feel to our words. A gentle answer turns away wrath, says Solomon. Any of you who are going to get involved in business, or in the diplomatic corps, or in the civil service, or whatever, you're going to have to face up to the fact that sometimes the way you put things matters a great deal. And it is no way contrary to the spirit of the Ninth Commandment to be tactful. Nevertheless, the dividing line between discretion and deceit is sometimes rather narrow. And the Bible does insist that unless a very great evil as is at stake in the situation, it is our duty to stay on the side of truth. Because truth matters. It is an absolute moral value inherent in the nature of God. We cannot abandon it. We cannot play fast and loose with it. We can't manipulate it for our convenience. Truth matters. Now, as I say, it's particularly, I think, in our commercial dealings with one another that the seams are beginning to come apart on this issue in our present 20th century Western society. Leviticus 19, I believe, has that chiefly in mind. That's why it binds together the 8th and the 9th commandment in the way it does. You see, Moses is welding together comments about not stealing with comments about not lying. Well, that's understandable. One of the most obvious and common ways by which we defraud one another is through lying, through dishonesty, through cheating. What Moses is interested in here, then, is the preservation of honesty in business. That's why I think also he includes that reference to not swearing falsely in God's name in verse 12 of Leviticus 19. Because in ancient Israel, there were no written contracts, generally speaking. The way in which you made a promise, you made a contract to somebody in the ancient world, was by swearing an oath. You promised to do it on the name of God in some way. Almost certainly, that's what Jesus has in mind when he makes comments about oath-breaking in the Sermon on the Mount. Perhaps you're familiar with that passage. You can find it in Matthew 5, verse 33. You heard it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. Now the background to this, as you'll discover if you were to look up Matthew chapter 23, is a piece of rather Jesuitical legalism on the part of the scribes and the Pharisees of Jesus' day. According to the law of contract, as they had developed it over the years, whether or not the oath you made to somebody was binding on you depended on the form of words you used in making it. For instance, if you swore by the gold of the temple, the scribe said you were legally bound to keep your word. The contract was legally binding. If, on the other hand, you merely swore by the temple, you could break your promise with impunity. It's a little bit like a legal form of the game Simon Says. You know, you have to listen very carefully to the way the commandment is given to know whether you're supposed to act on it or not. It doesn't take much to imagine the kind of conversation it gave rise to. Oh, good morning, Rabbi Benjamin. You promised to pay me that 10 quid you owe me today. Oh, I'm sorry, Rabbi Joseph. Don't you remember I only swore by the temple I would give it to you? Hard luck. Now, Jesus here is repudiating that kind of sophistry. Better to use no oath at all, he says, than to engage in this kind of deceitfulness. Say what you mean what you say in your dealings with one another. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. Whether you express your contract strongly or weakly, a promise is a promise. You should do everything you can to keep your word. We have exactly the same kind of Jesuitical equivalent of swearing on the temple, of course, today. Many a businessman takes refuge behind the fact that, well, I didn't put anything in writing, did I? Of course, in the old days you never used to have to put anything in writing. The City of London used to pride itself upon its motto, "My word is my bond." When a deal was struck in the City of London and two men shook hands on it, that was it. There was no going back on it. It was the pride of the City of London that my word was my bond. But not any longer it isn't. These days, finance houses and institutions have to have huge legal departments, tying up contracts so tight a flea couldn't escape through any loophole in them. Because if any loophole is left, it will certainly be exploited. And you know as well as I do, the recent cases of fraud and sharp practice, which we have seen in the City of London, sometimes at the very tops of most prestigious financial institutions. Business is business. The rule is watch your back and don't trust anyone. The new name of the game. The new motto. Do others before they do you. The prophet Jeremiah described a situation not unlike this in 5th century Jerusalem. Let me read it to you. It comes from Jeremiah 9. They make ready their tongues like a bow to shoot lies. It is not by truth that they triumph in the land. Beware of your friends. Do not trust your brothers, for every brother is a deceiver. Literally a Jacob. You know what an old swindler he was. Every brother is a deceiver and every friend a slanderer. Friend deceives friend, and no one speaks the truth. They live in the very midst of deception. With his mouth, each speaks cordially to his neighbor. But in his heart, he sets a trap for him. Should I not punish them for this, declares the Lord? Should I not avenge myself on a nation such as this? See, what Jeremiah is describing there is a society where the whole fabric of the community, and particularly of commercial dealing in the community, is being dissolved by lying. Everybody is pursuing their own atomized, individualistic ambition, and doesn't care how much they cheat one another in order to attain it. You can't trust anybody anymore, complains Jeremiah. Everybody's out to double-cross you, even members of your own family. Behind this veneer of good manners and respectability which they present to the world, they're riddled with conspiracy and treachery.
They're just a gang of crooks. The law of the jungle. Ought we to expect that God is going to remain idle while such disdain for his ninth commandment is taking place? No, says Jeremiah. God will avenge himself on a nation such as this. That's a solemn and a serious observation, and it's worth remembering that the particular judgment that God sent upon Israel in that situation was the tyrannical oppression of a Babylonian big brother. Once you see the lie has become a commonplace in the community at large, governments will not think twice about manufacturing evidence, rewriting history, twisting the truth. Of course they won't. If there are liars in the city of London, there will be liars in the city of Westminster, as sure as eggs are eggs. And once lying becomes the norm in politics, Big Brother is just perched, ready to descend. He lives on lies. They are his machinery of power. Deceit and lying, then, in the commercial world, could well become the avenue whereby Big Brother seeps in unawares to Britain. But there is a third area I want to look at, too, before we leave this subject of the Ninth Commandment. And that's the whole area of heresy and false teaching. For this, it seems to me today, is in danger of undermining the very concept of truth itself among the people of God. A key passage here is Deuteronomy 18, verse 20. A prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, said the text, must be put to death. We spoke earlier of the importance of the freedom of speech which the prophets enjoyed in Israel. The prophets embodied the accountability of government to God. They were personal representatives of that divine truth which the state could not suppress. And as a result of that, they were a vital defense against the abuse of political power. But of course, such a privileged position could be abused, and it was. Right from the start, the Bible recognizes the possibility of false prophecy and the damage it could inflict. Once again, it's Jeremiah who gives a passionate voice to his observation of it. The prophets are prophesying lies in God's name, he wails in chapter 14 of his prophecy. They are prophesying false visions, worthless idolatries, delusions of their own minds. It was a potentially disastrous situation when this happened, of course. When those who occupied the office of prophet failed to obey the ninth commandment and started bearing false witness, why, the very nature of truth as a moral absolute was cast in doubt, was undermined. The credibility of truth itself, revealed truth, God's truth, standing over against the manufactured stories which human beings may tell. The very nature of the existence of that sort of truth was placed in doubt once prophets started telling lies. And I have to tell you, my deepest fear for the church at the end of the 20th century is that something very similar is happening to us today. Perhaps I can best illustrate the threat, if you like, by reference to a book that has been published just recently by Professor Keith Ward. He holds the Regius Chair of Divinity at Oxford, and his latest book is called A Vision to Pursue. Professor Ward tells us in this book that he can no longer believe in an orthodox Christian doctrine of the Incarnation. He tells us on page 18, the whole gospel is founded on a mistake. What we have in the New Testament, he says, is not a witness to the real Jesus of history. For, he says in page 32, all past history is in principle irrecoverable. What we have in the New Testament, he suggests, is the religious experience of the early Christians rendered into narrative form. The purpose of that narrative is not to tell us what happened, because we can't know what happened. It is rather, he says, to evoke religious sentiment in us. It's no surprise to find that later on in his book, Professor Ward builds on this wholesale rejection of the historical basis of Christianity, what he calls a convergent pluralism, by means of which all the religions of the world, he says, will eventually be integrated into a common experience of spirituality. So Professor Ward has committed himself to the quest for multi-faith dialogue along with countless other contemporary theologians, and he's prepared to jettison Orthodox Christianity in order to achieve that goal. Well, I haven't got the time or the expertise to critique Professor Ward's book in detail. There's no questioning the brilliance of the man's mind or the persuasiveness of many of his arguments. But I simply want you to notice the presupposition which lies at the root of his book. For it's the presupposition that lies at the root of an enormous amount of contemporary theology. Namely this. The inaccessibility of objective truth. The inaccessibility of objective truth. According to Professor Ward, the Bible is not a book about ascertainable historical events by means of which God has revealed himself, which we can understand and which we can articulate. The Bible is a book about inward, subjective religious experience, which may mean different things to different people. It has to be, he says, because objective truth is not accessible to us, and even if it were, words are incapable of communicating such truth. Now, this sort of radical subjectivism is fast becoming the common garden wisdom, if you like, the unspoken philosophical assumption of late 20th century Western culture. He's not just influencing theology, he's influencing history, literary criticism, even the natural sciences. And I simply want to point out to you that it is fundamentally incompatible with the internal presuppositions of the Bible itself. Nothing makes that clearer than the ninth command. Think about it. You shall not bear false witness, says that command. Implicit in those words are two assumptions which stand in direct contradiction to Professor Ward's assumption. Implicit in the ninth commandment is the assumption, first of all, that there is a real external world of objective fact which we have access to through our senses and our minds. Secondly, implicit in the ninth commandment is the assumption that it is possible to witness to those objective facts either truly or falsely by means of words. If those two things are not true, the ninth commandment is vacuous and meaningless. You can't even begin to define what you mean by telling lies if those two fundamental assumptions are not affirmed. That there's a real external world of objective fact, and that you can speak about it either truly or falsely. And yet it is these most fundamental ideas underlying the very nature of what we mean by true knowledge that Professor Ward and others like him today are contradicting. To put it in the categories of philosophy, the Bible is committed internally to what's classically called a correspondence view of truth. That is, that a statement is true if it corresponds to an objective reality out there. That's how you know it's true. If it corresponds to the objective reality out there, it's true. If it doesn't correspond, it's false. But Professor Ward and many others today subscribe to various forms of non-correspondence theories of truth. Truth for them can't be defined by reference to any objective reality out there because they don't believe such a reality exists, or if it does, that we have no access to it. So when they speak of truth, they mean something, usually, which doesn't even consist of words at all, certainly not propositional statements. Truth for them is a state, perhaps, of integrity and honesty in one's own religious experience or values or whatever. Is that the nearest you can get to defining it? Little wonder that such scholars cast doubt, can't subscribe to, the doctrine of the infallibility of Scripture. For a phrase like the infallibility of Scripture is meaningless in their worldview. Little wonder they can summon little enthusiasm for evangelism. For in their worldview, the evangelist has nothing to say. Now, quite frankly, this kind of skepticism, which is becoming very characteristic of the late 20th century, takes heresy into a whole new dimension. The false prophets of the past denied revealed truths. They suggested the church had got it wrong in the way it verbalized the truth of God. It denied revealed truths. But the false prophet of the late 20th century denies the very existence of revealed truth. That, I say, is something of an altogether higher magnitude of seriousness. It's going to have disastrous consequences. Disastrous consequences for the church, first of all. For the New Testament is built on the claim that it testifies to the truth. The New Testament authors go out of their way to affirm the trustworthiness of their eyewitness accounts of the death and the resurrection of the Son of God. To be a Christian in the New Testament is to accept the reliability of those New Testament witnesses. In short, it is to believe the gospel. And the gospel is not an experience, it is a piece of news. It is facts about a man, who he was, what he did, his death, his resurrection. That's what the gospel consists of in the New Testament. To believe the gospel is to believe the evidence of witnesses about these facts. To try to reinterpret the gospel without such a framework of objective historical truth is to evacuate it of meaning. It's no longer Christianity we're talking about then, but some variety of existentialist philosophy or Oriental mysticism. The mission of the church can't possibly be served by such a theology. The mission of the church is aborted by such a theology. We have capitulated to another worldview altogether. Well, not only will it be disastrous for the church, I believe it could well be disastrous for our culture. It has been the strength of Western culture that it is committed to a correspondence theory of truth. It has been our belief, based on Christian revelation, on Bible knowledge, it's our belief in the accessibility of objective facts, which have been the foundation upon which all scientific advance, all Western knowledge has been built. And it has also, in my view, been a most important bulwark against the emergence of Big Brother. It's our belief that there is a truth out there that the government can't change, which enables us, when we need to criticize the government, to say, you're wrong, it isn't true. But once the very concept of truth is lost in this monistic mishmash, it no longer becomes possible to define what you mean by the lie or the truth. Society is ripe for Big Brother once it has lost a belief, a moral commitment to absolute truth. Lying outside the realm of human manufacture, lying, if you like, in God, at the very least is a higher moral value to which no state has any right to interfere. War is peace. Freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Such moral inversions can only be resisted if you believe there is an absolute truth out there by a means of which the veracity of such statements can be tested. Abandon the Ninth Commandment and its commitment to truth, and do you know what you get? You get Pravda, that's what you get. Interesting, isn't it? Ironic even that they published the last edition of that notorious vehicle of state propaganda in Moscow this week. They've shut down Pravda. Yet while the new Democrats of the East are trying desperately to put objectivity back into their news reporting, the theologians of the West are busy trying to deny that any such objectivity even exists. You know what Pravda means in Russian? It means truth. But truth Big Brother style. Truth defined by the manipulation of the evidence, by the distortion of the facts, by the rewriting of history, by the inversion of language itself. Professor Ward, as I understand him, is telling us that that kind of truth is the only truth there is. That the truth of the gospel is a truth based on the manipulation of evidence, the distortion of facts, and the rewriting of history. That all truth is of that caliber. At least if he isn't saying that, I'd very much like to know what he does mean. Well, I beg you to believe that it isn't so. You shall not bear false witness, said the ninth commandment. And I don't believe the apostles did. What's more, I don't believe Jesus did. For this reason I was born, and for this cause I came into the world, to testify to the truth. The Roman governor replied, "What is truth?" The cynical agnosticism, perhaps, of a man who's heard too many philosophical debates. Tragically, he didn't wait for an answer. He left the audience chamber intent on putting pragmatism, the pragmatic demands of politics, above such metaphysical inquiries. And the result, of course, the result of Pilate's repudiation of Jesus' truth claim was that a little later that morning, he went down in history as the man who crucified the truth. Big Brother stamped on the face of the Son of God himself that day. The Prince of Darkness was never more triumphant in the whole history of the world than that day. But because it was the truth he witnessed, that triumph was short-lived. The God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob has glorified his servant Jesus, said Peter to the crowd in Jerusalem. You disowned the holy and righteous one. You killed the author of life. But God raised him from the dead, and we are witnesses of this. And it is that risen Jesus who stands amongst us today. It's that risen Jesus we witness to this morning. Not as some subjective experience, having no greater claim to authenticity than an LSD trip or a schizophrenic hallucination. No, it is as one who has been raised from the dead before many witnesses that he stands amongst us this morning. He has been marked out, defined, accredited as the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead, says Paul. And it's for that reason he affirms to every man and woman and child on the face of this globe, I am the truth. No one comes to the Father but by There is no more culpable act of false witness for the church than to deny Jesus that exclusive status. Let's pray together.